Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then, add the final touch with 2 for $8 on select 2.5 or 3-quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hey guys, I'm Georgia, and welcome to a new episode in my history series, or welcome back. If you've been hanging around here for a while, you might recall from a few months ago my video on 4 shocking deathbed confessions, in which I mentioned the story of a woman called Margaret Gibson, and how she confessed in her dying moments to the murder of a man called William Desmond Taylor. Well, this video is going to be the full story of that. And don't worry, there's much, much more to the story than Margaret Gibson and her confession. In fact, a lot of people dismiss her confession entirely and don't think she had anything at all to do with Taylor's death. This is a fascinating story of old Hollywood with plenty of suspects and theories to explore, still unsolved nearly 100 years later. Chances are that you've never heard the name William Desmond Taylor before, but if you were at all interested in film a century ago, his would have been the name on everyone's lips, having started as an actor but soon finding that he had a knack for directing. By the time of his death, he had directed around 60 silent films, all with varying success. But his life wasn't always full of the glitz and glamour of Hollywood. William Desmond Taylor wasn't even his real name, born as William Cunningham Dean Tanner in April 1872 in Carlow, Ireland. He was a son of Jane O'Brien and retired British Army officer Major Thomas Kearns Dean Tanner. He was one of 5 children. It seems his family were pretty well off. He was privately tutored as a child in French, German, and history. And from the ages of 13 to 15, William attended Marlborough College in England. And it seems like his father very much intended for him to follow in his footsteps into the British Army. But William wasn't cut out for it and failed his entrance exam. Some sources state that his father was actually embarrassed by William and the inclination he showed towards wanting to be an actor, which was something only done by the poor and or effeminate, the gays. As a result, William was shipped off to Harper, Kansas in the USA in 1889, where he worked on a ranch called Runnymede. Now, this wasn't a ranch as you would think of them back in the 1800s. It was actually something called a dude ranch or a guest ranch, which started to pop up across America to host guests who were drawn to them thanks to the romanticisation seen in the media of the Wild West. But still, it would have been hard work. When the owner of this Runnymede ranch died, I have no doubt that his family probably expected William to return back to Ireland, but he never did again, instead heading to Missouri and then Illinois, where he worked a number of odd jobs, always aiming towards his goal of one day becoming an actor. In 1895, he actually got a break when he joined a touring theatre company where he worked for the next 3 years, touring across the country. When his sister Elizabeth suddenly died, William was given a small inheritance which enabled him to move to New York City and open his own business, which was nothing actually to do with acting, it was a furniture and interior decorating business. He also meets a woman called Ethel May Hamilton, who was an actress herself with a wealthy family, whose father was an investor in an English antique store. He eventually ended up hiring William himself, so I kind of get the feeling it was a marriage of convenience. In 1901, William and Ethel end up marrying, giving birth to a daughter the following year, who they named Ethel Daisy. The next few years would be a roller coaster of a marriage, it seems, with William being a very heavy drinker, probably having affairs and also suffering with random bouts of amnesia, or at least that's what he told his friends and family anyway. Eventually, his business began to go under, the debt started to mount up, and so he makes the decision to abandon everything, including his wife and now 6-year-old daughter. He leaves his business, his city, and even his name behind, starting a new chapter of his life under the name William Desmond Taylor. He would spend the next few years travelling across America, doing odd acting jobs, and even trying his hand at a bit of gold prospecting, it seems. At first, his family would think that he was suffering with another one of his random bouts of amnesia, but they soon realised that was not the case. He wasn't coming home. William gets his break into film thanks to his wealthy upbringing and years of writing lessons, actually, landing multiple small roles as extras in cowboy movies. Soon, the right people began to notice him, and he was given more and more prominent roles before signing with a company in 1914. That same year, he played the title role in the silent film Captain Alvarez and appeared in 27 movies in total before he began to dabble in directing, finding that he was a very talented director. Over the next few years, he would direct 59 movies in total, becoming a name known by everyone in Hollywood, and even worked under Paramount Studios in a time when film studios were king. But this didn't make him exempt when the war eventually came around. William was drafted and he finally got into the army. He never saw combat but spent time in England and France, even earning the rank of major, the same as his dad. Something that was common knowledge to everyone in Hollywood was that William Desmond Taylor was a gentleman through and through. With his Irish charm, everyone who knew him said that he was a very fine man, and he had women hanging on to his every word. He eventually fell in love with an actress called Neva Gerber, but she was already married, and from what I can gather, her and her husband split, and she was even engaged to William, but the actual divorce wouldn't come through until after his death. After his disappearance, his own wife, Ethel, had applied for a divorce, and it had been granted, so he was technically a single man. In 1918, Ethel May and Ethel Daisy were actually back home in New York City watching the newest hit film, Captain Alvarez, only for Ethel to exclaim to her daughter, "That's your father," when William appeared on the screen. So Ethel Daisy wrote to her father, care of the film studio, and in 1921, William went back to New York to visit them. From what I can gather, William was happy enough to have his ex-wife and daughter back in his life, and even named Ethel Daisy as his heir, although he was never going to win any Father of the Year awards, that's for sure. Other women he had close relationships with in Hollywood included Mary Miles Minter, a tragic child star and daughter of a very controlling stage mother. When Mary was a teenager, she began to star in William's silent films and soon became enamoured with him, despite him literally being old enough to be her father. Mary was in her late teens at the time and William was well into his 40s. There's very differing views as to whether the two of them actually had a romantic relationship at any point, but it does seem to me that William just viewed her as his protégé. He definitely had a soft spot for Mary, perhaps as she was the same age as his estranged daughter, but he probably knew that their age gap would never allow for a scandalous romantic relationship. But we do know that Mary was definitely hopelessly, completely in love with William, there's no denying that, and she would continue saying so for the rest of her life. After his death, love letters were found which read, "Dearest, I love you, I love you, I love you. Love always, Mary." There may have actually been a romantic relationship there, but nobody's entirely sure. And then there was Mabel Normand, who he was also rumoured to be involved with romantically, and again, there's a lot of questions. There were definitely constant rumours of his relationship with Mabel though, and Mabel was still significantly younger than William at the time, but she was in her late 20s, so it was much more socially acceptable. She was another silent film actress and later a director and producer, and she was one of the most sought after comedy actresses of the time, and she struck up a very close relationship with William. Again, some think it was romantic, some think they were just best friends. The story goes that the two became close due to Mabel's drug addiction. She was addicted to cocaine. William was famously anti-drugs and would do everything he could to help people suffering with addiction. Nobody really knows where his anti-drugs crusade stemmed from. Perhaps from his time at war, he saw some things that set him on a mission. But when Mabel came to William, reportedly asking for help with her cocaine addiction, William was all too happy to help in any way he could, and hence they became friends. After his death, there were rumours that William was the one who provided Mabel with drugs, but the opposite was actually true, it seems. He may have actually got himself in trouble by standing as a roadblock between Mabel and drugs, standing up to the drug dealers of Hollywood. Obviously, this story is from a century ago. Hollywood was mysterious to even those closest to the world back then. So it is pretty difficult to get a story straight in this case, and I am aware that the information might not be 100% correct. So just take all of the finer details in the story with a pinch of salt. We'll delve into all of this more later in the video when we're talking theories, but the general consensus is that William was on a mission to save Mabel from her drug addiction. So as you may be able to tell, there was no shortage of women after William's affections, that's for sure. But I feel like this might be a good time to just slip in there, that there have long been rumours of William being bisexual or even gay, but of course there's no way of knowing for sure a whole century later. William Desmond Taylor was 49 years old when he died in his bungalow on South Alvarado Street in Westlake, Los Angeles on the 1st of February 1922. That evening, Mabel Normand had been round to visit, staying for just 45 minutes for a chat and to pick up a book before William walked her back to a chauffeur-driven car. The two apparently spent a lot of time discussing literature, so this was normal for them. It was 7:45 p.m. and she blew him a kiss as the car drove away. William's death would later be noted by investigators as being just mere minutes later at 7:50 p.m. or around that time. Two neighbours, Faith and Douglas McLean, would later come forward saying that they'd heard what they assumed to be a car backfiring at around 8 p.m. that night. They didn't know the specific time, but around then. Faith decided to investigate the noise and looked outside going to the front door, and in the evening light saw someone coming out of William's bungalow. The person closed the front door, walked down the steps, and even made eye contact with Faith, and calmly walked towards the street. Because of how calm and collected this person was, Faith had no reason to think it was anything untoward. William was a Hollywood director, he had people coming in and out of his house constantly. So, as I said, she and her husband put the noise down to a car backfiring and went back about their business, forgetting about it entirely until the events of the next morning. Faith would later say, "It was dressed like a man, but, you know, funny looking. It was dressed in a heavy coat with a muffler round around the chip and a cap pulled way down over the eyes." She assumed it was a man, but had no way of knowing for sure. Around 8 p.m. also, William's chauffeur called the home but received no answer. 15 minutes later, he turned up at the house in order to return his car keys and the light was on, but there was no one answering to the doorbell, so he just left. Another neighbour, silent film actress Edna Purviance, returned home around midnight and she also noticed that William's lights were still on, but assumed that he was probably still working and didn't want to disturb him. No one would know that William Desmond Taylor was lying dead in his home until around 7 a.m. the next morning, when William's butler, a man called Henry Peavy, turned up to work. Henry is described by some as a butler or a valet or chef. He just worked for William doing all of the odd jobs that needed to be done, it seems, and he'd been working for him for around 6 months at this point. Upon entering the house, Henry soon saw William dead on the floor and quickly fled from the house, shouting that Mr. Taylor was dead, to which Douglas McLean and the landlord rushed over, and Edna, who I mentioned just a second ago, immediately called Paramount Studios before anyone even called the police.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator. Roll with the sausage breakfast burrito. Buddy it up with a honey buddy. Or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes. And then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
You may recall me saying before that William worked for Paramount, and studio representatives turned up at the scene very quickly before even the police, and were quickly able to clean up around the home. But why would they need to do such a thing? Well, this was a time when actors, directors, producers, writers would be signed to work under one specific studio, either for an allotted amount of time or for a certain amount of movies or whatever other terms. When you signed a contract with a studio, you were kind of signing your life away, and the studio could control everything you did, who you socialised with, who you dated. Everything about your public image was theirs to own, and if you were involved in any scandals as somebody employed by the studio, it would directly reflect on them. So it was in the studio's best interest to keep the lives, and deaths apparently, of their employees scandal free. And at the time of William's death, Paramount were coming off of the back of two pretty serious scandals already. First, there was the Fatty Arbuckle scandal. Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle worked very closely with Mabel Normand in a lot of films. They were both comedy actors. Until in September 1921, Fatty was arrested and charged with the rape and murder of a young actress called Virginia Rapp during a party in San Francisco. As you can imagine, this was a very serious accusation, and his latest movie, Crazy to Marry, was very quickly pulled from cinemas nationwide. Even the fact that Fatty Arbuckle had thrown a party was bad enough, as this was in the midst of prohibition and alcohol was illegal. The fact that a woman was found dead at this illegal party was horrifying. The most damning evidence against Arbuckle was the word of a woman called Maud Delmont, who told the police she'd watched Arbuckle pull Virginia into a room, and half an hour later Virginia was screaming and then she was found dead. She told the police Arbuckle did it, and so he was arrested and charged with manslaughter. He, of course, denied the accusations entirely, saying after a few drinks, Virginia had become hysterical and said she couldn't breathe. He said that at no point was he ever even alone with her, and that she was so intoxicated that they put her in a room of her own so she could recover. Very, very long story short, Virginia's body was found in a horrifying state, and there ended up being three trials in this case. Delmont was found to be an unreliable witness, as she had a very shady past of her own, and even sent telegrams to attorneys saying, "We have Roscoe Arbuckle in a hole. Here's a chance to make some money out of him." Medical evidence showed that Virginia apparently had a chronic bladder condition, and even though original witnesses said that her body was found in a terrible state, apparently the autopsy found there were no signs of violence on her body, and a doctor who treated her before her death said that she told him Arbuckle hadn't assaulted her. Twice the jury deadlocked, and at the third trial in 1922, witnesses who knew Virginia in life testified in what was basically a character assassination. In April 1922, Arbuckle was acquitted after just 5 minutes of deliberation from the jury, who said they felt like a great injustice had been done to him. This case is still very divisive to this day, and nobody still can agree whether Arbuckle was innocent or guilty. But the point is, when William Desmond Taylor died, Paramount Pictures were still in the midst of this scandal, and protests against their films are already being held nationwide. Fatty Arbuckle never really worked again. He did start to make a comeback in talkies in the early 30s, but then he died. And then there was another scandal as well, one which involved drugs and a man called Wallace Reid, another silent film actor who was known as the screen's most perfect lover, the all-American family man. Whilst working on a film in 1919, Reid was seriously injured in a train crash and needed stitches for a head wound. He was given morphine for pain so he could continue to work through it, and soon he got addicted. It got to a point that he couldn't even function without morphine, especially as the film studio put more and more pressure on him to get through films. They would pump them out at an extraordinary rate, and the actors just had to be able to keep up. In 1921, Reid was arrested in Portland, Oregon for violating prohibition law, yet another blemish on Paramount's record. Wallace Reid soon became a shadow of his former self, and in October 1922 he collapsed and was sent to hospital. Just months later he would end up dying in a sanitarium, and this is often said to be the first major celebrity drug scandal. So it's safe to say that Paramount Pictures did not want another scandal on their books. Their number one priority when they heard about the death of William Desmond Taylor was to ensure that there was nothing the police could find in his bungalow that would make him look bad, so they came in and did a bit of cleaning up. Nobody knows exactly what the studio removed from the home that day. I mean, that would kind of defeat the point of them doing it in the first place, but we can assume they probably took some bootleg alcohol and love letters, most likely letters from Mary Wells Minter herself. From the very first moment, any investigation was completely compromised. The first detective to arrive at the scene was Detective Tom Ziegler, who had literally zero control over the scene. People were coming and going as they pleased, and even without the studio already having cleaned up, there would have been no hope for an investigation. Not long after the arrival of the detective, a random man arrived on scene and announced himself as a doctor, after apparently having been treating someone nearby. This doctor walks in, takes a cursory look at the body, and declares that William had died of a stomach hemorrhage. To this day, nobody knows who this doctor was, and he disappeared as fast as he arrived. When the actual deputy coroner arrived on scene, all he had to do was turn over William's body to see clear as day his cause of death was actually a gunshot wound. He had been murdered. It was only at this point that the detective realised how serious this death was and called for backup and cleared the crime scene. Apparently there was very little blood for a gunshot wound. A motive of robbery was quickly ruled out, as William was found to have $78 cash in his pocket, which was a lot more money back then than it is now, and a 2-carat diamond ring on his finger. He was also wearing a gold locket with Mabel Norman's picture inside, which perhaps does suggest the two had more than just a platonic relationship. As far as investigators were aware, nothing was missing from the home, apart from the things the studio had already disposed of course. According to an article by Heather Monroe on Medium.com, they did leave behind a lady's nightgown and a handkerchief monogrammed MMM, presumably belonging to Mary Miles Minter. Just these two things alone were enough to send the media into a frenzy, describing William's bungalow as a love nest. As well as this, it also soon got out to the media that this man wasn't even called William Desmond Taylor. He was William Cunningham Dean Tanner, who had abandoned his wife and daughter back in New York over a decade earlier. So not the all-American Hollywood gentleman he was thought to be. The coroner was a man called Dr. A.F. Wagner, and his autopsy showed that William was murdered by a bullet wound in his left side, which entered the body about 6.5 inches below the armpit. It penetrated both lobes of the left lung, passing through almost the entirety of his body. The coroner found the bullet just beneath the skin, 4.5 inches to the left of the right shoulder, and the cause of death was undoubtedly the gunshot wound. The verdict of the jury at the later inquest was gunshot wound of the chest inflicted by some person or persons unknown to this jury with intent to kill or murder. William's funeral was soon held at St. Paul's Pro Cathedral, with people from all across California attending and 2 whole truckloads of flowers delivered to the chapel. Mabel Normand was reportedly so distressed by William's death that she ended up collapsing at the sight of his coffin. In the immediate aftermath of the death, investigators had 2 main suspects. Henry Peavy, the butler, and a man called Edward Sands, his previous butler. So let's explore those for a bit. Henry Peavy, I suppose, was the obvious suspect to explore first. He was the one to discover the body, he had intimate access to William's life, and just 3 days earlier had been arrested on charges of social vagrancy for being lewd and dissolute. It seems he was caught soliciting boys in a public park, so regardless of whether or not he was killer, he was probably a bit gross. I don't have much more information for you on his crimes other than that, I'm afraid, apart from the fact that William was scheduled to appear in court on his behalf the very next day. Henry was intensely questioned by police under suspicion of the murder, but in the end it was decided that it likely wasn't him. William had bailed him out after his arrest and was due to appear in court the next day, as I said, so William's death wouldn't do Henry much good. Henry had left the home the previous night, not long after Mabel Normand had arrived, and didn't return until he found the body the next morning. Henry said that on several occasions, William had been annoyed by mysterious people walking around outside his house, and that he wondered why William didn't carry a gun with him for safety. He did have a gun, but he kept it on his bureau, not on his person. Apparently, once Henry and William had a conversation in which Henry said that someone could just walk up the stairs and attack William whilst he was in his bedroom, to which William responded, "No, he won't. I keep my gun on the bureau, and if I hear anyone walking up these stairs and he doesn't answer when I call him, he's a goner." Apparently, on more than one occasion, William did actually chase people away with guns. Whether these people had more ominous intentions or if they just wanted to explore the home of a movie star and detective, we don't know. Despite investigators pretty quickly striking Henry off as a potential suspect, there was one reporter for the New York Daily News called Floribel Murr who refused to believe that he was innocent and thought she could trick him into a confession. Henry Peavey was a black man, and Floribel had learned from the movies that black men were deathly afraid of ghosts, apparently, so she decided to use this to her advantage. She approached Henry and told him that she would pay him $10 to take her to William's grave in the Hollywood Park Cemetery. When Floribel and Henry arrived at the grave, a man called Al Wineshank came out of the shadows covered with a white sheet. Yes, really. And pretended to be the ghost of William, saying, "I am the ghost of William Desmond Taylor. You murdered me. Confess, Peavey." They really thought that would be enough to spook him into confessing to the murder. Only Wineshank was from Chicago, he had a thick Chicago accent, and William was Irish, although I think he had an English accent. Henry, as you would, just burst out laughing and confessed to nothing. Which brings us to Edward Sands, who seems to me to be a much more likely suspect. He was William's butler before Henry and was a bit of a criminal himself, with prior convictions for embezzlement, forgery and serial desertion from the US military. Sands went through life under multiple different aliases. His real name was actually Edward Fitzgerald Snyder. He spoke with a very bad Cockney accent, but he was actually born and raised in Ohio. The summer before his death, William had spent multiple months in Europe, leaving Edward Sands back in California. And in that time, Edward had forged his name on several of William's checks, wrecked his car, stole a load of his clothes, and then just vanished. As you can imagine, William was not happy about this, and on his return, he issued a formal complaint with the police, with a warrant being issued by the LAPD charging Sands with forgery and larceny. He wasn't arrested, but sources say that he actually visited his family in Ohio around November 1921, and that same month actually enlisted with the US Coast Guard under his real name. And then on the 4th of December 1921, William's house was burgled. The back door was broken in and several items of jewellery were stolen, as well as his entire stock of special gold-tipped cigarettes, which I didn't even know existed. Some food was eaten out of the fridge and dusty footprints were found on the beds. In the following few weeks, the jewellery was pawned in Fresno and Sacramento, and the person pawning the jewellery was identified as none other than Edward Sands, confirmed further by handwriting analysis. In mid-December, one of the gold-tipped cigarettes was found on Taylor's doorstep, and on the 27th, both pawn tickets were mailed to him with a note that read, "So sorry to inconvenience you, even temporarily. Also observe the lesson of the forced sale of assets. A Merry Christmas and a Happy and Prosperous New Year. Alias Jimmy V." Analysis also confirmed this note to be written by Edward Sands. This is all very weird behaviour, and it's not crazy to think that he may have returned to murder Taylor a couple of months later. However, after the receipt of this note, there's never been any trace of Sands ever again. There were many reported and rumoured sightings, but nothing actually solid, and nobody knows what happened to him, he just disappeared. In a Los Angeles Record article dated the 3rd of February 1922, so just the day after the murder, it says that detectives were quietly seeking a young New York broker whose identity is being kept secret in order to question him. The young man was said to be prominent in the movie world and was a friend of a prominent actress. Detectives didn't give much more information than that, it seems, and as much as I researched, I couldn't find out if they ever actually found this guy, who he was, and why they thought he might have information. That same article says they are working on the theory that William was murdered by a love killer, potentially a man who resented his attentions to some woman, or maybe some woman who resented his attention to some other woman. Which is actually a very nice segue into our next potential theory of Mary Miles Minter. Now, in all of the rehashings of this theory I've seen online, very few people think that Mary herself was responsible for William's death. We all know that she was absolutely, hopelessly in love with him and was distraught after his death. She would say for the rest of her life that he was the love of her life. Unless it was a kind of, if I can't have you, no one can kind of situation, I just don't see this being likely. Mary was a love-struck teenager, she wasn't a murderer. Plus, there's literally zero evidence to support that being the case. This theory actually goes a bit deeper than that.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card. The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Mary Miles Minter, as I mentioned earlier, was a child star, and as with so many child stars, she had a very pushy mother behind her, Charlotte Shelby. From the way that Charlotte's described, it seems that she had more love for stardom than she did for her actual daughter. She just wanted fame and, more importantly, fortune. She was a mother living vicariously through her child. Mary's first stage appearance was in 1911 under the name Juliet Shelby. But when that play went on to open in Chicago, where there were laws against under 16s performing, Juliet Shelby was miraculously replaced by Mary Miles Minter, who we now know was the same person. Charlotte basically used the birth certificate of a dead cousin to fake her daughter's age. In no time at all, Mary's name was all the rage, one of the top names in Hollywood. Although, according to a Los Angeles Times article, sadly only two of her movies actually survived today. Mary lived her entire teenage years under the thumb of her mother. Mary couldn't breathe unless her mother said so, and she certainly couldn't date. But as we know, now 19-year-old Mary was enamoured with William, writing him love letter after love letter telling him so. In Charlotte's mind, any suitor probably would have been deadly for Mary's career. Charlotte needed her daughter to maintain her career to keep the life that she was used to. No, it was best if Mary just steered clear of men entirely. But then again, Mary was a teenager, of course she had an interest in men. I'm sure that that would have been horrifying enough to Charlotte in itself, but when she found out that the man that her daughter was writing love letters to was almost 30 years her senior, something had to be done to stop it. This theory goes that Charlotte killed William to stop him from pursuing a relationship with Mary, although all evidence does seem to point to the fact that he was not actually interested in her. Years later, there was a statement made by Margaret Shelby, Mary's sister, also an actress who was just as under the thumb of their mother. In May 1937, she made a statement that on the night of William's murder, Mary had been locked in her room by her mother because she feared that Mary was going to run away with William. Mary managed to escape the room and left the house, but returned home around 8:30-9 p.m. in a hysterical state. Apparently, Mary then picked up a book and began reading about the South Sea Islands, seeming incredibly interested, laughing, but Margaret later said that she picked up the book and it was very, very dull, so it was very odd behaviour from Mary. It was all very odd behaviour, but it's also worth noting that when Mary was notified of William's death the next day, she was shocked, unable to be consoled. Margaret originally said that her mother wasn't at home at all that day, that she was out all day and night, and apparently at night she was hunting certain men to locate Mary. However, a later book called A Castle Killers writes that after Mary was freed from her room, Margaret witnessed her mother go into the basement and reappear with a gun. Mary later told Margaret that she'd seen Charlotte shoot and kill William. So what was it? Did Margaret see her mum go to the basement, or was she not home at all that day? The implication, obviously, is that Mary went straight to William's house after her escape from her bedroom, so Charlotte followed her there and killed him. But as we know, Mabel Normand was actually at the house and she never reported anyone else being there. William died within 15 minutes of Mabel leaving, so it's unlikely that Mary appeared in that small window of time and then witnessed her mother shooting him. The neighbour, Faith, also only saw one person leaving the house. She assumed it was a man but did concede that it could have been a woman she wasn't close enough to see, and it was dark. The most damning piece of circumstantial evidence against Charlotte Shelby is that her gun was apparently a rare 38 caliber pistol, the same kind of rare bullet used to kill William. Apparently, when this information came out, she threw the gun into a Louisiana bayou and lived in fear of being arrested for the crime for the rest of her life. However, that never actually happened. Two separate district attorneys declined to prosecute Charlotte, even though it was later rumoured that Charlotte killed another one of Mary's lovers as well. All in all, there's a lot of contradictions with this theory, but it does seem that Charlotte really might have been crazy enough that people thought it could be true. Mary herself even later said in interviews that her mother killed everything she ever loved. For years after this, Mary and Charlotte locked heads in a battle over Mary's money. They fell out and didn't speak for a very long time, but did reconcile eventually. If Charlotte did kill William to protect her daughter from scandal, though, it didn't work. Mary's career was ruined after this point. She barely ever worked again and died unknown in 1984. Next, we have the theory of Mabel Normand and her involvement with drugs. Despite being the last person to see William alive, Mabel herself was never really considered a suspect, although Henry Peavey very much thought it was her. As I mentioned earlier, Mabel Normand reportedly had a pretty bad cocaine addiction and had turned to William to help her get off the drugs. He figuratively, and maybe even literally, stood as a block between Mabel and her drug supply, and it's probably safe to say that drug tycoons would not have been all too happy about this. A huge amount of the drug supplies market would likely have been the film studios. All of the stars were addicts of some kind, and the studios let it happen because they worked better when they were on drugs. They had to be up all night, they had to keep going. But also, they weren't allowed to be on drugs because that could cause a scandal and could reflect badly on them. It was a very multifaceted thing. According to author Robert Garreau, in the days before his death, William had actually gone to federal prosecutors and had offered to testify against Mabel's cocaine suppliers. I'm sure we'll probably all agree that this is a pretty good motive for his murder. I mean, it's not crazy to think a powerful drug lord could hire somebody to turn up at his home and shoot him. It could have been a professional hit. The killer was in and out very quickly, leaving very little evidence behind, and was very calm and collected. There's a website called silentera.com and a newsletter on there called Taylorology, written by a man called Bruce Long. Taylorology delves so insanely deep into this case. I've used it a lot for my research, but honestly, I can't even begin to scratch the surface of just how deep this goes. So if you're particularly intrigued by the story, I will recommend you go and have a read. Of course, it'll be linked down below. Basically, Bruce Long writes that William himself may have actually been a drug pusher, a complete 180 from the anti-drug crusader angle. Taylorology points out that no credible first-person witness was ever able to support this rumour of William being a drug pusher, so it was all just speculation and rumour. That was until film director Marshall Neilan came forward in 1958, just before his death, saying that he himself had been addicted to drugs and that William Desmond Taylor had been his supplier. The rumour says William himself had been supplying drugs to Hollywood since 1918, including to Mabel Normand and Wallace Reid. Customers would apparently arrive at his home carrying hollowed out books containing cash and would part with hollowed out books containing drugs. Remember how Mabel left his house that night holding a book? Could that be the reason that William was leading the drive against drug dealers in Hollywood? Was it because he wanted the market all to himself? Was he leading a double life? Again, with this being a century ago, all we can really do is speculate, but there was some press at the time suggesting that he was into drugs himself. And rumours don't really tend to come out of nowhere, there's never really smoke without fire. If he was indeed a dealer himself, he would have had no shortage of people who wanted to hurt him, I'm very sure. I realise those are two very, very different angles there. William, the anti-drug crusader, and William, the drug dealer. Next, let's talk about the theory surrounding Margaret Gibson, the deathbed confession I mentioned at the very beginning of this video. Margaret Gibson was a silent film actress herself who appeared in 147 movies between 1913 and 1929. Whilst a successful actress, she never quite reached the notoriety of people like Mary and Mabel though. Margaret's name never came up in relation to William's case. It seems they were in one or two movies together, but that was it. They weren't particularly friends, no connection was ever made. That was until Margaret's death in 1964, when she was now known as Pat Lewis. Pat slash Margaret didn't have many friends or family, it seems, although she was close enough with one of her neighbours. In 1935, Margaret fled to Singapore for unknown reasons, where she married a man called Albert Lewis. They had a very happy marriage until her husband was killed in the war when the Japanese dropped a bomb on the factory he worked in. So in 1949, Margaret headed back to California, where she moved into a small home in the Hollywood Hills, living on a widow's pension under the name Pat Lewis with only her cat for company. On October 21st, 1964, she suffered a heart attack in this home. A man called Raphael turned up to visit his mother at home to find out she wasn't at home, instead over at her neighbour Pat's house, who was on the floor in a great deal of pain. The ambulance took over 45 minutes to arrive, having got lost in the hills. And as she waited in pain, Pat slash Margaret was clearly in great distress. She'd recently converted to Roman Catholicism and was concerned that she hadn't confessed her sins. She asked for a priest, but of course the mother and son were unable to get one on such short notice. So she confessed to them instead, saying that she'd been a silent film actress and had killed a man by the name of William Desmond Taylor. She went on to say that they'd nearly caught her at one point, so she had to flee to Singapore. Raphael would say that she made several other claims, but in the panic, he couldn't recall what she said. They just dismissed her claims at the time. She was a delusional, kindly old recluse. She wasn't a killer, and she definitely was never an actress. Margaret sadly wouldn't survive her heart attack and died on the way to hospital. A few months later, these neighbours were named as beneficiaries to Margaret's estate, so gained access to her property to begin to clear it out, which is where they find a trunk containing letters and theatrical sales of a younger Margaret Gibson. She had been telling the truth about being an actress. At this point, the neighbour remembers something further. She already knew of her involvement with the murders, as one day the two of them were watching a TV show called Ralph Stories Los Angeles, which aired a small piece on the murder. Margaret became hysterical and said that she'd killed William. She thought that everyone had long forgotten about it. But apart from these two confessions, there's no other proof that Margaret Gibson had anything at all to do with William's murder. She provided no motive, no reasoning, just the statements. However, in 1923, Margaret had actually been arrested at her home on federal felony charges involving an alleged nationwide blackmail and extortion ring, and later was charged with extortion. Lots of people think this whole thing could have been linked to the aforementioned ongoing Fatty Arbuckle trial, that Hollywood was just corrupt and there was something much deeper going on. The trial had the lives of every single Hollywood figure under public scrutiny, and maybe Margaret snapped. Maybe she knew something she shouldn't have known. Maybe somebody blackmailed her into killing William Desmond Taylor. Or maybe her and William had remained in contact since their movies together all those years earlier, and she had a reason to kill him. Whilst it's speculated that the studio removed letters from the house from Mary and Mabel, is it possible that they also removed some letters from Margaret that they were actually able to keep completely under wraps? Maybe Margaret was in love with William herself and insanely jealous of his other relationships. Again, this is all speculation. We don't know anything for sure. Mostly because any files relating to this case have long been lost. They're gone. Finally, there are a couple of other theories which are a little bit more out there, I think, but I want to mention them, throw them in the ring regardless. You will see some mention online of a theory that Edward Sands, the disgraced valet, was actually William's brother, Dennis Dean Tanner. This theory was actually started, it seems, by reporters at the time who were just looking to sell papers, but the truth is that it actually was investigated and there was found to be no link between the handwriting of the two men, Dennis and Edward. Dennis abandoned his own wife and children in New York City just a few years after William did the exact same thing, and he wasn't ever really seen again. It's believed that he may have moved to LA himself and quietly worked with his brother, but nobody really knows. The man just disappeared completely. Again, it's a theory that you see online, but we don't know any motive that Dennis would have to kill his own brother. Which brings us to our very last theory here, one of a love cult, and the fact that William was actually apparently a gay man. Apparently it was the studios that fed false information to the press about finding a closet full of lingerie, dirty pictures and love letters after William's death to cover up the fact that he was actually gay. Some think that the studio didn't go into the house to clean up love letters, but they actually went into the house to plant things. They planted the lingerie, they planted the monogram handkerchief, and they planted some love letters. This was apparently the reason why William left his wife, why he was never able to have any significant romantic relationship, why he wasn't interested in Mary and Mabel. Apparently, he was a member of a love cult where men would gather, smoke opium, and do very gay things. This theory just came from whispers at the time, people saying they'd seen William at these gatherings, and was first reported in the New York Times for being repeated in newspapers across the country. It's kind of a rumour that sprung out of something small and became this big thing. Why his apparent homosexuality or apparent involvement in this opium love cult may have led to his death, I can't be too sure. Maybe it was a homophobic attack, maybe he slighted the wrong man, maybe all of this tied a lot deeper to the drug scandal rumours. But again, I can't really tie it together for you. I told you the last couple of rumours were a little bit more out there. If you ask me, I think either the Charlotte Shelby rumour or the Edward Sands rumour have the most standing to them, but even then there's not really enough evidence to outright accuse either of them.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
If the rumors that he was a drug pusher are true, then again, that could be a very easy explanation, but I'm not convinced they are. Everything you find online says that he was adamantly anti-drugs, except if that was a ruse all in itself. See, there's no easy answer in this case, and I'm sad to say that it will probably remain a mystery for all time. Anyone who knew William Desmond Taylor in life is probably long gone. Hollywood at this time, and I suppose even still is just a pit of secrets and deceit. Nobody really knows what's going on unless you are smack bang in the middle, and even then, that is never coming out. Perhaps Margaret Gibson really was the one responsible for his death. I can't think of any reason why she'd confess to this if it wasn't her, unless she was protecting somebody else, or she was just a delusional old lady. What do you think in this case? I'm very intrigued to hear everyone's thoughts in the comments if you're watching this on my YouTube video, or if you're listening on my podcast, then tweet me, Instagram me with any theories that I didn't mention. My Instagram and Twitter links will be in the description. Thank you so much for watching, and I will see you in the next one. Bye, guys.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.